This is Kareach Mikan and Mikan. Mr. Chairman Judd Greenberg, His Excellency the Minister for Israel, His Worship the Mayor of Johannesburg, Mr. Cooper, Mr. Maisel, and dear friends all, I need not tell you that I am delighted to be in your midst this evening. I appreciate all the kind, generous, and altogether undeserved words of praise which were uttered here this evening about my humble self. It is nice to hear them, and I was particularly happy that they were spoken in the presence of Mrs. Silva. Or it's nice to lay up some credit for oneself in one's own home. I am delighted to be in your country, which in so many ways reminds me of the youth and the pioneering spirit of my own country. I'm happy to be here for yet another reason, because one of your great and distinguished leaders and citizens, whose reputation is worldwide, and whose services to our great movement will remain forever inscribed in the annals of our people, one of the real Chassidei Umot HaOlam, General Smuts. I am very happy to be here too, and to acknowledge in public the thanks of those of us who at the United Nations had the responsibility for presenting the case of reborn Israel and the recreated state of Israel, and in winning the support of the representatives of the nations there assembled. I say I'm glad to be here to acknowledge our sense of debt and appreciation for the substantial support which you received during those critical and decisive years from the government of South Africa. My contact with it was by way of its white and blue penny stamp, which I offered for sale from door to door at meetings and public gatherings and in synagogues on the eve of festivals and holy days. I was an energetic salesman, coaxing and enticing the sluggish customers, often with unpremeditated eloquence, which, with all its patent shortcomings, never lacked either fervor or sincerity. When my sales for a single day grossed a dollar or two, I returned home all aglow and triumphant, Kemotse Shalal Rav, as one who finds great spoil. My commission was, of course, nothing more than a star-studded dream, but I always felt amply compensated. The stars which shone so brightly in my youth have accompanied me in later life. And the music and grace of those flowering years have remained. There can be no sweeter recompense, I assure you. It took nearly 50 years for that little white and blue stamp, which so modestly but tenaciously held its place on cards and inside letters and on the back of envelopes, as a tolerated but unrecognized symbol of a people's hope, to be acknowledged finally as the authentic symbol of a sovereign state. Today, colorfully arrayed in garbs of charming design, it proudly holds its authorized place on the face of all posted mail from the State of Israel, and it traverses officially the highways of the world as one to the manner born. We had faith in that little blue and white stamp 50 years ago, 40 years ago. Behind it was an invincible idea. The idea made itself manifest at the very first Zionist Congress, though it did not receive the official sanction of our movement until the Fifth Congress in 1901. We were then not only a stateless people, but a landless people as well. We needed not only freedom and independence as a people, but land upon which our people could be settled, into which it could be rooted, and from which it could launch the offensive for political freedom when the time came. Other peoples, too, in many parts of the world, were fighting for their sovereignty and independence at the turn of the century. But they, these peoples, though not independent or sovereign, they were at home on their own soil. Theirs was the problem of freeing themselves from a foreign power, from imperial domination. The Jewish people had not yet reached that stage. That was to come later. The preliminary stages had first to be reached and passed. Jews had to be brought into Palestine, and land had to be acquired for them on which to settle. The land base for our political struggle had first to be built. Our people had not only to be brought into the land, our people not only had to be brought to the land, but to the soil as well. They had to be rebuilt through the soil. That was, as you will recall, a central theme of our national Renaissance movement. For a strong national base and for a national economic reorientation, we needed land, which would be inalienably the property of the Jewish nation, and which would be acquired by means of a national fund collected in small amounts on a national scale from the masses of the Jewish people. Like all great revolutionary ideas, this idea too went back, as is already indicated by His Excellency, the minister from Israel. This idea too, this revolutionary idea, went back to ancient precedents for its inspiration. All revolutions, in a sense, are restorations. Mankind frequently moves forward by going back to basic ethical concepts and insights from which it had detoured. The humanism of the Middle Ages, and the Renaissance were kindled by the rediscovery of the classics of ancient Greece, and the French Revolution, and the American Revolution poured their new wine into very old bottles. The land laws of ancient Israel, which were promulgated at the time of the first settlement of Canaan, and which decreed that the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine, was the inspiration of the idea behind the Jewish National Fund. The fund was patterned after an old design and echoed a prophetic social vision of long ago. This fund of ours went back to other precedents and other recurrent experiences of our people. It relied upon the masses of the Jewish people to redeem the land for the Jewish people. It did not put its trust in the benevolence of the wealthy few. In all history, the privileged few have never served or saved the many. A people must redeem itself, or it is unworthy of redemption. Our movement for national restoration was always a mass democratic movement. The rich, the favored, the comfortable, with some rare and notable and laudable exceptions, and the worst exceptions. But by and large, they rejected it, they resisted it, almost to the very end. And fatuously, some of them are still fighting it, out of bitter frustration and chagrin. You will recall that it was poor and often persecuted men who sailed the uncharted seas to the American wilderness, who in hardship and struggle laid the foundations of the first colonies, and whose descendants fought the Revolutionary War for their national freedom. And I'm sure that your own experience here in this country, and the experiences of the people who settled here, is no different. It was so with the settlement of Palestine and the subsequent war of liberation for the establishment of the State of Israel. Pioneers are moved either by an inner urge or by an outer spur. All others wait upon success or the prospect of success. They sit down at the table after the meal is prepared by others. The Jewish National Fund, dear friends, had the large patience of a people and its brave common ways. It did not wait upon success. It created it. It plodded patiently along through the first lean and unrewarding years. Up to 1920, only 25,000 dunams of land had been acquired, mind you. But it carried on, undeterred, undiscouraged. In times of political disturbance or business recession in Israel, in Palestine, when private acquisition of land declined, the fund did not withdraw discouraged from the market. On the contrary, it increased its purchases. It was determined to fulfill its historic mission, come what may. It was braced by the will of a people, and in turn, the will of the people was reinforced by the example of its own indefatigable efforts and its own quiet, patient, steady, relentless activities. Today, fortunately, we proudly record the fact the fund has come to be the greatest non-governmental land purchasing agency in the world. and its contributions to rural and urban development in Israel, to irrigation and afforestation, and drainage, to the establishment of new colonies and settlements and villages for the absorption of the myriads of new immigrants who are pouring into the country, I say that its contributions are monumental. Reference was made this evening to the tremendous new project which has been inaugurated recently through the efforts of the Jewish National Fund for the draining of the malarial-ridden marshes of the Hule region, an area of over 60,000 dunams of land, which will not only convert that area of land into healthy land upon which human beings can be settled and creative life brought into being, but whose waters which now go to waste in these marshes will be able to irrigate, it is estimated, an additional 200,000 of dunams of land. And I make bold to say that in spite of the political difficulties which are being encountered at the moment, and in spite of all the political maneuvering that is going on under threatening and the occasional disturbances, this project is going forth to completion. Over 7 million of trees were planted during this last year. And what trees mean to that denuded country, you know, especially those of you who have had the privilege to visit that land. It is like a human being, a tree planted in Israel. It's like another human being, to use the biblical simile, brought into that country. The wastes of the Negev are being irrigated today. Barren sand dunes are being reclaimed for human habitation by this fund. In the course of nearly three quarters of a century, dear friends, since its inception in Chibat Zion, our Zionist movement brought into existence many fine and noble institutions, many fine agencies and instrumentalities, but none, I believe, and I believe you will agree with me, none surpasses the Jewish National Fund in popular appeal and in the affection in which it has been held through the years, and none expresses so admirably the essential genius and the social vision of our movement, rising above party and partisan ideologies and serving the universal needs of an unfragmentized people. We should derive much inspiration from the history of this fund for all the tasks which lie ahead for our movement in the days to come. There was always a Sabbath mood about this fund, a quiet sanctity which never left it. Its ideal was never lost in the hard realities of the workaday world in which it operated. Perhaps this was due to the fact that it never saw its ideal as ever fully accomplished. Its work was never done. Always there was more land to be acquired, more desert and wilderness to be reclaimed, more people to be settled. For many of our people, the establishment or the re-establishment of the State of Israel appeared to be an ideal fully realized, a task finally accomplished. And there was proper rejoicing in their hearts, a pride, an exalted mood, a contentment. And who would begrudge them, and who would begrudge ourselves this hour of rejoicing, when the mouth is filled with gladness and the tongue with song, after such a long deferred hope and the desolation of the centuries? Should not those who sow in tears reap in joy? But many of our people, dear friends, mistook this day of triumph for a perennial Sabbath, for a yom shekulo shabbat umenucha lechaye ha'ulamim. An era which is an unending Sabbath, and one which brought rest with it forevermore. I'm afraid that such lyrical hopes must remain in the nature of a shir le'atid lavo, a song for the distant future and some ultimate cycle of time. They are not intended for the perilous times in which we find ourselves, and in the midst of the massive, burdensome task which still await us. There is yet much work to be done by us before the young state of Israel will become strong, stable, and secure. And we must put our hand to that work with a will. Israel is still surrounded by unreconciled enemies who refuse to make peace, who dream of a second round, and who are rearming themselves for a propitious hour of renewed hostilities. The status of Jerusalem remains undefined, and the United Nations has so far evaded its responsibility for a final decision. The resources and the economy of Israel are being seriously drained by the dire needs of military expenditures. Dark clouds of a new world war are moving ominously over the face of the earth. At the moment, we prayerfully hope that these clouds have lifted a bit, for they are lowering over the world and over the Middle East as well. The economic problems of the new state are increasing in intensity, and they will not be solved quickly or easily. And for several reasons into which we need not go here this evening. Principally, of course, for the reason of the large immigration which will continue to come into the country. And we must not recoil from these hard weekday and workday realities of building a state, fusing a people, defending its borders, developing its economy, and absorbing endless waves of impoverished immigrants all at the same time. I don't know of a little people in the history of the world which was confronted simultaneously by such grave complexity of problems and is wrestling so valiantly with them. We must not be frightened away from the enormity and the complexity of the task. We must not recoil from these hard realities. We should not wish to cover them up, these unpleasant realities, these unavoidable vexations and the discords which exist. We should not try to apologize for them, nor to resent criticism of them. They should be faced by those inside and outside of Israel frankly, and ways of improvement and amelioration should be sought without pride of opinion, without partisanship, without dogmatism. And no ready-made ideologic garment fashioned in the doctrinaire schools of the East or of the West will suit the unique and extraordinarily involved political, economic, social, and cultural complex which is present-day Israel. The garment will have to be cut to measure. And much skill, patience, loyalty, and self-sacrifice will be demanded in order to meet the situation. The citizens of Israel are making heroic efforts in austerities and in sacrifices to meet their and our problems, while at the same time continuing to build their national life on a scale which is amazing the world. They know that their battle days are not over. There isn't a man or a woman in Israel who is relaxing because the state was established 3 years ago. I'm afraid that we, outside of Israel, in the diaspora, many of us have begun to relax both in our political and our economic responsibilities. And there is danger in this for the hard-pressed state of Israel. Political demobilization on the part of world Jewry in these days of strange political alignments, when former enemies are being wooed and erstwhile allies are being alienated, is to encourage unpredictable and possibly dangerous policy shifts and reversals on the part of governments under the plea of military necessity. We experienced such reversals, at least we in the United States, in the past, though fortunately sounder and fairer judgment ultimately came to prevail. Economic relaxation on our part at this time will dangerously undermine the economic life of the state of Israel and therefore also its political position and its security. And we cannot allow it. What we have helped to build, we must now make secure. Now that the tides of the world have finally carried our storm-tossed ship into port, we must not suffer it to be shipwrecked there. We who are one with the valiant sons and daughters of Israel in the glorious comradeship of struggle will remain with them, I am sure, in an enduring fellowship of labor until peace and security will come to be abidingly theirs. My dear friends, I had the rare privilege quite recently to spend a few weeks in Israel. Those weeks were for me one great Yom Tov, a holiday of the spirit. Not merely that it was a fulfillment of a wish of mine to revisit Israel after an absence of nearly 2.5 years, and not because the reception which I received at the hands of the Israeli was so cordial and warm. I was grateful for all that, being merely Basar Vadam, like every other human being, I was very pleased with it. But that wasn't really the reason why my visit there, in spite of the hard and rugged things which I saw. And I like to see things as they are, but I also like to see through things and into the heart of things. It was for me a Yom Tov because I saw another act in one of the most exciting dramas which have ever been enacted on the stage of human history. And I use my words, dear friends, with... I try to use them with precision, with accuracy, not at all in hyperbole or in sermonics. What is unfolding there before the seeing eye is one of the most exciting dramas in the history of the world. I saw what a people could do, what the Jewish people could do, given half a chance, in the face of colossal and forbidding and discouraging and spirit-breaking circumstances. I saw how men and women can rise on the rungs of suffering and hardship to higher levels, increasingly higher levels of achievement. When I asked some time ago what made it possible for the people of Israel, so few in numbers, militarily so unprepared, and I knew how unprepared they were because I was there at the time, to outface an alignment of invading armies backed by numerous populous peoples and keep the invaders beyond the borders of Israel. What made it possible for these relatively unarmed and unprepared men and women to fight a war of liberation to victory? I was told that one of the great factors was that, as they put it, Ein Brera, there was no choice. They were fighting with their backs to the wall. Well, that may have accounted for the victories in the war, although I'm not at all sure that that was the real explanation. But certainly Ein Brera will not account for what is going on today in Israel. It cannot explain the amazing dynamism, that overflowing creative energy and confidence, this abundance of spirit, which manifests itself on all sides at every turn. Something else must explain what is transpiring in Israel today, and I think there too perhaps the explanation can be found in the Bible, which gives us the clue to so many correct interpretations of the experience of our people. When the spies who were sent out to spy out the land of Canaan returned, they reported to Moses. You will recall that the land of Canaan was beautiful, flowing with milk and honey. An attractive land, but they said, Ephes, the Azam, the people living there, is very powerful, and the cities are strongly fortified. Nay more, in contrast to the peoples there who are like giants, we are like pygmies. Two of those who returned reported, yes, that may be so. But in spite of these facts, Alo nale, the Yarashnu ota, ki yachol nuchala. We will nevertheless go up, for we can take possession, for we have the strength to master the situation. I don't know of anything that can give you the insight into what is going on in Israel today, except this spirit of Joshua and this spirit of Caleb. Yachol nuchal, alo nale. We will go up. We can master the situation. There is this irrepressible, indefeasible will of a people. Will not to stay put, will not to be satisfied with what is, because the few hundred thousand Israeli, after their state was established, could have settled down quietly to their day-by-day business and be satisfied with what they had, and perhaps done what logical realists would have advised them to do. You have your own serious economic problems. You have the problem of establishing your government, setting up the apparatus of government. Don't complicate your economic life by opening your doors wide to the inrush of hundreds of thousands of impoverished immigrants. Be satisfied, be content. You have a state now, you have your home now. But there wasn't a soul in Israel who for a moment entertained that thought. Not only because their sense of loyalty to their people would never have permitted it, but they knew what they were there for. They were the vanguard of a great people which was resolved to build in that ancient land a great nation and a great civilization.
and they had in them the willpower, the Joshua and the Caleb genius of Alonale and Yahol Nuchal.
That you see when you visit Israel today. That little country today is one large workshop. I visited it from Metula up in the north to the new city of Eilat on the Gulf of Aqaba. I was privileged to be there when the first cargo ship coming from the ports of Africa reached Aqaba. I saw it all. At least as much as one can see, traveling day after day through the length and the breadth of the land, the houses which were being built, the factories which were being constructed, the roads, the settlements, the vast irrigation projects and resettlement projects, the teeming, throbbing, creative life going all around. To see the machinery which was being used, the tractors, the bulldozers, building. I'll never forget the sight in one of the colonies where I was taken by a representative of the Jewish National Fund to see on a huge American bulldozer sitting on top of it, a Yemenite Jew with his pointed beard, you know, and his flying pied sitting on that throbbing machine, guiding and controlling it. And I said to myself, that indomitable Yemenite Jewish theology wedded to Yankee technology is irresistible and indefeasible. I saw it all around. Men working, men from the East and the West, men from the Orient and the Occident, men and women doing the most arduous work. Manual labor of the hardest kind. Uncomplaining, and all of them, regardless of what their work was, the engineer and the carpenter and the bricklayer and the man who was digging the ditches, all united in the reverent fraternity of men working for a common cause. A great workshop one sees in Israel today. I left with a definite impression that was a going concern. The going is hard. Life is very rugged. While no one hungers in Israel, there are few comforts and no luxuries. And of course, the people there would like to have it easier. And they're entitled to have their life easier. But more than ease, they want more Jews in Israel. And they are content to submit themselves to continued austerity, to a lower standard of living, just so more Jews could come into Israel. I visited the Ma'abarot, the camps of the transient immigrants. There are 110 of them in Israel today, crowded. Life is hard. Almost primitive in certain parts. But somehow one does not commiserate with them for two reasons. First, because the life of many of them was no easier in the lands from which they came. And secondly, and more important, they felt, the immigrants in those camps, they felt that they were being sustained by a hope that there was a people thinking of them and working for them and planning for them. They were not alone, they were among friends. And above all, they were at home in the land of Israel. One found hopefulness even where normally one would find depression. I found that the Israeli are very alert to the realities of the world in which they find themselves. They find themselves surrounded by unreconciled enemies. And while they are doing their utmost to encourage peace and to persuade their neighbors to come to definite peace terms and agreements. For they are a peace-loving people. For the genius of our people has always been for peace. Nevertheless, they are resolved not to be taken unaware. They are resolved not to be caught unprepared. They will never be driven into the sea. They will fight and they will win. They made their land theirs by sacrifice, and by sacrifice they are prepared to defend it. What they fear most, what they look upon as the most dangerous front in their struggle for national survival, is not the military front. What they fear is an economic breakdown. An economic disorganization which might encourage the enemy. And in this struggle against economic defeat, we alone, we Jews of the world outside of Israel, can give them the economic weapons. They are faced with many problems besides the economic one. I wish you had the time to dwell on some of them this evening. I hope that we'll have the opportunity at some future time to discuss them with you. The problem of the education and the school systems in Israel, the problem of the bitter political partisanship, the spiritual problem. And yet somehow, I left the country persuaded that they will solve these problems, given time and patience and the right kind of leadership in Israel. They will solve them because they have brought into that country with them so much of memory and hope, of skill and ability, of love and of loyalty. And they will know how to build. They will know how to build on their past and for their future. I was in Israel during the Independence Day, the Yom HaAtzmaut, and I visited two places on that day, or on the eve of that day, to be exact. On the morning of that day, I visited the Har Zion, Mount Zion. And there I was taken into what they call the Martev HaShoah, the cavern of disaster, of destruction, a cave inside of Mount Zion. And there I saw 31 urns containing the ashes of our unremembered, unidentified martyr dead from 31 concentration camps of Nazi Europe. Hanging above these 31 urns was a memorial light of 6 branches. One branch for every million of our people done to death in the gas chambers of Hitler's hell. That was the Galut. That was the past. And that they brought back with them too to Israel. Because they don't want to forget the past. We dare not forget the past. Never! Never must our children forget that past. The past which our people wrote in their blood and their tears for 2,000 years. that's there in Mount Zion is a perpetual memorial of an unforgetting people. To its unknown martyrs of the Galut. And that same evening I was taken to another mountain, Har Herzl, Mount Herzl, where the remains of our immortal leader, the prophet of our movement, have finally found their last and honored resting place. It was dusk, and in the midst of an assembled throng representing the political and the spiritual and cultural leadership of the new state of Israel, in the midst of rare and moving solemnity, the flag of the new state was raised, and then the whole assembly broke forth in the national anthem. And when that was done, a great fire was kindled on the top of Mount Herzl, signalizing the advent of the Day of Independence. And as this fire was seen from distant hills and mountains, celebrating Israeli there kindled similar fires, and before long throughout the land of Israel fires were burning in celebration. Laihudim haita ora v'simcha v'sason. And throughout that night they were dancing in the streets of Jerusalem and in every city and town and village and hamlet of the new land of Israel. There was the future, built upon the past. This is how an immortal people builds, never yielding to defeat, unruined, on the graves of 10,000 defeated hopes. This is how our people builds and knows how to build. And this is the spirit which is animating our people in Israel today. They will build well, dear friends, for in their eyes there is vision, and in their mind there is the thirst for knowledge and for truth. And in their souls there is indomitable courage and love and loyalty. They will build in such a way that that little country will be a blessing, not only to themselves and to their children, but to us and to mankind. I may be something of a mystic. I do not know any Zionist can work for decades on end, in the face of all frustrations and seeming impossibilities, and not have the equipment of at least a bit of mysticism in his makeup. I somehow feel that out of this little country, which once before gave mankind a light and a leading, which has survived to this day, there will come forth great themes which will yet startle the world. I don't know of a spot on God's earth where there is such a concentration today of intellectual energy, of initiative, of the will to achieve great and fine things. I don't know of a country which has such a physical stimulation to an attuned people as Israel has, a land where every hill and valley, stream, road speaks to them
are of a great and glorious past, of immortal heroes, of men of rare grace of spirit who walked with God. Why, these people so equipped intellectually and spiritually with the challenge of that history and that environment, why, they will achieve monumental things. And do not for a moment imagine that it's great peoples who inhabit great territories who produce the great cultural and spiritual values for mankind. Not at all. History records that it was great peoples who inhabited little countries who made the most significant and enduring contributions to the sum total of human knowledge. Little Judea gave the God idea and the moral code to the whole of mankind. Little Greece carved the highway for art and beginnings of science and philosophy for the world. Little states of Italy were responsible for the revival of learning in Europe. And the little country of England, before it was the great empire, taught mankind self-government and parliamentary routines of a free people. Zieith Beharim Ubahar Besinai. When God wished to reveal himself to our people, he did not select the towering Himalayas or the Alps, but the little humble Sinai for his revelation. And it was not out of a stately tree, but out of a humble bush that the fire of revelation came to the great emancipator of the world. I have faith in that little country and its brave little people. And if we will only stand by them during the next few critical, searching, trying years, which will test them to the utmost, and which will also test us, if we will stand by them and give them the help which they require, especially the economic support, to enable them to live through these critical years. They will come through. They will come through strengthened, ennobled by their experiences. And they will come bearing gifts to us and to mankind. And when I meet a group of Zionists, as I do tonight, I always feel like telling them, after coming back from recharging myself, as it were, in Israel, good people, you have done a marvelous thing in recent years, a marvelous thing in helping to make that possible. Carry on until that which we help to build is established firmly, soundly, and duringly. Thank you.